Welcome back to the Mike Boyle Restaurant Show. Special show, special segment. We're going to talk with a guy named Anson Frederick. Am I pronouncing that right, Anson? I'm struggling with your name. I don't know why.
You know, Mike, close enough. You know, I've been called worse. So, Frederick is what it is, but you were close enough, so I'll give you an A for effort.
Like my favorite movie from 1965, Hombre with Paul Newman, where he says, anything but bastard will do. All right, so folks, if you were to think, this is the restaurant show, you know I love my beer. So if you were to bring up the words Bud Light, if you were to say the words Bud Light, if you were to think about it, what would you immediately think about? You would think about the precipitous fall of Bud Light because of one particular incident. But you know what? There's more to it than that. And I've got the guy that can talk about it. He was raised in Ohio, went to a very good prep school, St. Xavier's, St. X, it's called. And then he chose to go East Coast. He chose to go Ivy League. He went to Yale. And then when you get out of Yale, what do they tell you? The Holy Trinity, banking, consulting, or grad school. So he goes to grad school. He goes to Harvard. Gets out of Harvard with an MBA. I got an MBA. My MBA is from the University of Hawaii. I'll tell you what, the closest I got to Harvard was we did Harvard case study at the MBA program at the University of Hawaii. But anyway, he goes into the corporate world, and the next thing you know, he's with Anheuser-Busch. Yeah, Budweiser. And the next thing you know, he is the president of sales and distribution. Yeah, he spent some time in Colorado. He's got a little bit of a Colorado connection. But he wrote a book after he left Budweiser called Last Call for Bud Light, The Fall and Future of America's Favorite Beer. And I read the book. I loved it. Let's talk about it. Anson, welcome to the show.
Mike, thanks so much for having me. Really looking forward to it.
Listen, let me ask you a question here. Out of all the interviews you've done, how many people read the book?
You know, I can tell you the ones that didn't read the book, based off where it went. Like, you know, I enjoyed going on Adam Carolla's show, but it was clear that Adam Carolla, I don't even think he knew who I was or why I was there, and he went off on his own thing. So he was a little bit of a wild man. But other guys, you know, I was on Mike Rowe's show, he read the book, that was great.
I thought that was a good interview, Tucker I enjoyed Carlson, that.
I don't know if he did or not, but...
I enjoyed that little video segment.
The book, though.
Well, and you know what? Yeah. That, it's called The Restaurant Show, where we talk about restaurants, travel, movies, books, sports, or whatever I feel like talking about. And that's why I can get the biggest authors there are, because I read the book. So I've got some interesting takes. Anson, it wasn't just what the Dylan Mulvaney incident may have been the straw that broke the camel's back. But there was a history of Budweiser making a major shift corporately. It goes back to about 2008 in the recession. Why don't you give the listeners a brief little history of how Budweiser went woke, how they went from stockholder focused to stakeholder focused. I had never even heard that term. I've never spent a day in the corporate world. So if you could take the listeners through that a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, let me give you the short history here, then we can dive in a little bit deeper, Mike. But you know, just going back to even the founding of Anheuser-Busch, I mean, this is one of the greatest American corporate entrepreneurial stories of all time. The company was started in the 1860s, 1870s. This is when you had people like the Vanderbilts, you had the Rockefellers, you had the J.P. Morgan of the world. I mean, kind of these big bears. You had the Bush family. And the Bush family ran the company up until 2008. So you had, in 2008, you still had Bushes running Anheuser-Busch. Vanderbilts were gone. Carnegies were gone. Rockefellers are gone. This was a company that had survived two world wars. It had survived the Depression. It survived Prohibition. I mean, there was a time in this company's history they couldn't even sell beer in this country, and they sort of survived it through generations. They did it by being a St. Louis-based company, the center of the country. They had family members that really understood sort of the core American beer drinker, that American consumer. They were involved in sports and music festivals, and you name it. So it created this like amazing, amazing business. In 2008, a big thing happened. Unfortunately, by the fourth generation, August Bush IV was coming on some tough times. The company had way more probably private jets and helicopters. At the time, they owned SeaWorld and a bunch of other things they probably didn't need. And it was taken over by a Belgian-based company called InBev. So it was a European company called InBev. this company was much more focused on cost cutting, much more focused on kind of the bottom line than really kind of growing the business. And I think like that started a series of events that really culminated, unfortunately, with the partnership with Dylan Mulvaney. After the company was taken over by this Belgian-based European company in 2008, the headquarters of the company was shortly moved. The sales market headquarters was moved from St. Louis, Missouri, which is, again, kind of the epicenter of the geographical center of the U.S., was moved to New York City in kind of 2016 and 2017. When that happened, you started recruiting a lot of people that were from the East Coast that only went to East Coast schools. A lot of folks only lived in New York City their entire life, and they had never been to a Walmart or a Kroger or a 7-Eleven in their life, nor knew anyone who had.
Yeah.
And then shortly thereafter, you started working with a lot of New York agencies, marketing firms, others. And as there was this really new idea coming to vogue called stakeholder capitalism, and then downstream of that, programs like ESG, Environmental Social Governance, and Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, DEI. And the company was very uniquely susceptible to really picking up a lot of these, I call it fads and corporate trends about how to run a business, because they were European-owned, because they had moved the headquarters to New York, because they'd hired a lot of different people. And the short story is that's how it ends up with Alyssa Heinerschneid, who was the VP of Bud Light at the time when the Dylan Mulvaney partnership happened. You have Dylan Mulvaney, whose face ends up on a can of Bud Light and gets put out to tens of millions of Dylan Mulvaney's followers, which, I mean, funny enough, happened to be mostly like underage girls. But yeah, that's a whole different story. So that's the short story, and then we can dive into any specifics you want to get into.
Well, and I want to get into it more, Anson. I really enjoyed the book. There's some things in there that are a little bit too technical for a guy like me, but you know what? The Budweiser mystique, the Budweiser history, anybody that's ever been to St. Louis, folks, Budweiser still owns that town. Go to Busch Stadium. Try to find, there may be a tap on the third level out in right field, but it's all Budweiser. It is a Busch town. We're going to be back with Anson in just a moment. We've got to take a quick break. We're talking about beer on the Mike Boyle Restaurant Show. Frederick, he is the former president of Anheuser-Busch Sales and Distribution. Anson, you joined them in about 2010, 2011. You left in 2022. Yeah, big move. They go from St. Louis to New York. A lot of people that were with the company for 10, 20, 30 years didn't want to make the move. They didn't want to go to New York. It developed more of a New York East Coast mentality. Did you see this coming? Did you see this transition? Because, you know, back in 2010, 2012, 2013, DEI wasn't a commonly used term. Did you see this coming, and did you see the shift?
Yeah, I mean, I did see the shift, and I saw this coming. And I saw it coming not only in Anheuser-Busch, but in broader corporate America as well. So, as you mentioned, I left Anheuser-Busch about a year before they did the partnership with Dylan Mulvaney, but I saw some of the writing on the wall. This is during the COVID time period. I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, and you might recall in Atlanta, this is where Governor Kemp in 2021 signed the Voting Rights Act, which required people to have an ID to vote. That didn't seem that crazy to me, but you had companies like BlackRock, which is the largest asset management company in the world. They're the ones that are pushing the stakeholder capitalism, ESG sort of philosophy. They were one of the first companies that said, we're against this law, we're going to push back on it. And then lo and behold, you had companies like Coca-Cola that said, hey, we're against this voting rights law, Delta Airlines. You might recall Major League Baseball, they canceled the All-Star Game
in
Atlanta, Georgia,
yep,
that year in 2022. And then they moved it out to Coors Field in Denver. And you know, you just mentioned that, you know, in St. Louis, you can't find anything but Budweiser or Bud Light anywhere. Where the same thing in Coors Field out in Denver, you can't find anything but Coors Light. So when I was president of Bush, you know, that really bummed me out. Like, you know, all of a sudden, the All-Star Game, which, like, you know, we're doing in Atlanta, I was living there, we're going to have Budweiser everywhere, all of a sudden it gets moved to Coors Field. There's not a single Budweiser in that entire stadium. So, you know, I saw this happening in broader corporate America, where you have all these companies getting involved in political and social issues. At Anheuser-Busch, it was changing as a corporation, whereas when I joined, it was a meritocracy. When you get promoted based off your ideas, your contributions, you know, what you bring in terms of a value to the company. And then really in kind of the post-George Floyd era, all of a sudden the company was introducing sort of like diversity dashboards, where you were seeing sort of the racial and ethnic makeup of your team, and people were getting promoted based off of the racial and ethnic makeup of their teams. Our marketing was changing in a big way. Instead of winning Super Bowl Ad Meter Awards every year, which was always sort of the gold standard. All of a sudden, we're trying to win these European Conline awards. And these European awards, you would win them by having marketing that met their requirements of diversity, equity, inclusion, or ESG. And it just didn't really speak to a lot of the sort of American consumers. So I saw a lot of these problems that were coming. And that's one of the reasons I actually left Anheuser-Busch and started a company called Strive Asset Management with a buddy of mine from high school named Vivek Ramaswamy. At the time, this was, I didn't expect him to run for president and run for governor and do all these other things he was doing. That was not part of our initial plan. But our initial plan was we saw a lot of businesses getting involved in social and political movements in sort of that 2020, 21, 2022 time frame. I think a lot of people were frustrated with that happening. And there was just a better opportunity to create new businesses that were just going to stick to their mission, stick to hiring based off of merit, stick to ideals like free speech, and I thought those businesses would do better. So we started coming up with Strive Asset Management because we saw a lot of these problems coming. Now, the one thing I was completely shocked about is that Anheuser-Busch doing that partnership with Bill and Mulvaney, and then most importantly, not being able to explain it or articulate it to consumers, especially as millions of their customers ditched the brand, billions of dollars of value the company were erased, and unfortunately, lots of employees and other folks lost their job along the way. So it was a sad tale. And it was just really tough to see so many colleagues impacted with zero accountability from the board on down at Anheuser-Busch.
It's interesting. It took Anheuser-Busch 15 years of flawed marketing partnership and loss of millions of customers and a 17,000-person survey to understand that Bud Light drinkers just want cold beer and good times. You know what, Anson? I wish I'd known you then. You could have called me up. I could have saved you a lot of money, a lot of time. I could have told you that. Beer drinkers just want a cold beer and good times. And so some of the, how instrumental was a guy named Andy Goeler? Andy Goeler, G-O-E-L-E-R, was with the company for 40 years, and I kind of got the impression that he was the last man standing, trying to keep Budweiser between the lines, keep Budweiser saying, we want cold beer and good times. That's what our drinkers want. Now, did that have an impact when he left?
Yeah, so Andy Goeler was an absolute legend in the beer industry.
Right.
He was a 40-year career veteran at Anheuser-Busch. I think he started his career there in the early 1980s. He actually launched Bud Light in the early 1980s. He was on the original brand team. They had tons of different jobs of the year. Ran Budweiser for a while, ran the craft brewery portfolio for a while. And he came back in, I believe, 2017 to take over the Bud Light brand after there was a European-Belgian guy who had been running it for the past couple of years and really started the downward trend of Bud Light with some poor marketing. Andy really revived it in a big way. Do you remember the Dilly Dilly campaign by chance?
Of course.
And the phrase Dilly Dilly that was used. So he kind of did the whole Dilly Dilly thing. He had the whole medieval sort of a world that he created. And he was the one that was really kind of holding on as the company was shifting. They were taking a lot of money from Bud Light, shipping it overseas to some of their operations in China and in Africa and others to try and grow those markets as opposed to like really invest in Bud Light. So Andy was doing all he could with kind of declining budgets on Bud Light to keep it afloat. And then unfortunately in 2022, Andy, retired after 40 years with the company. And who was Andy replaced by? He was replaced with a lady named Alyssa Heinerstein. And Alyssa was the first female VP of Bud Light in the history of the brand. And, there's nothing wrong with that. I think there's like lots of females that could probably do a great job if they understood the Bud Light consumer. But that really wasn't Alyssa. Alyssa had grown up in New York City, went to prep schools in New York City, went to Harvard for undergrad, Wharton for business school. I don't know if she'd ever drank a Bud Light in her life or, knew someone who had before she took over the brand. And Alyssa, during kind of COVID, was very proud about some of her progressive politics. She was featured in the New Yorker talking about some of her progressive politics and how she brings those to work. And then I almost think you couldn't have found a worse person to run Bud Light at the time than somebody who had very like progressive politics, had never been, spent any time at all in the Midwest or in sort of the center of the country where Bud Light's incredibly strong. And then, it was incredibly telling. Not only was there the whole Dylan Mulvaney partnership, which was flawed, but that same week there was the podcast that came out with Alyssa on it, where she essentially said the Bud Light, you know, kind of consumer was fratty and out of touch.
Right.
And I mean, I can't think of like a worse way to try and like drive sales at a brand by calling your customer base kind of fratty and out of touch in a demeaning and derogatory way. That's not going to win your consumers back. At the same time, you know, all the underage girls that follow Dylan Mulvaney on Instagram, they can't even buy beer. So I don't know, you know, who they were trying to target, who they were trying to find. But obviously, it's been a disaster. Bud Light sales are now down almost 50% 2 years later after that partnership.
You know what, Anson? Budweiser advertising. And listen, in the interest of full disclosure, I am a Coors guy. I grew up in Southern California. When getting Coors, you drove all the way to Colorado to bring back a trunk full of it. You know what I'm talking about. It was only in 11 states before it went nationwide. Pete Coors and I are dear friends. We've ridden the Rockies together. We've traveled together. But the Budweiser advertising, it was legendary. And whether it was the Clydesdales, whether it was Dilly Dilly, I'm at the Cleveland All-Star Game in 1997, and we're watching the game, and on my right is a guy I went to college with. On my left is a guy I'm talking to. I turn to my college buddy, and I say, I think I know the guy on the left. And he says, you don't know him. What's the matter with you? We're in Cleveland, Ohio. And so about, I say it once or twice, and finally I turned to him, and I said, God, you look familiar with him. And he said, I love you, man. Well, that advertising campaign, you were a little young for that, but it was, I mean, it was, everybody knew that commercial. You know what I'm talking about. You got away from it.
Definitely.
You used to own the Super Bowl commercials. You got away from that.
That's it. They I mean, they own that. They won the Super Bowl Ad Meter Award. So USA Today, they come out with what's the favorite Super Bowl ad for, I mean, 10 straight years. They won it. 10 straight years, the 90s and early 2000s. And it was the Budweiser Frogs. It was the What's Up Guys. It was the I Love You Man Guys.
Yeah.
It was Real Men of Genius. I mean, it was like just one hit after the next. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, like once the company gets taken over, again, they brought in like marketers from Belgium because they thought those were better to understand the U.S. And then marketers from New York City. But that was never who was doing it. It was always just folks generally from, you know, the Midwest and Midwest agencies that kind of got the whole pulse of the country, weren't worried about being politically correct. They were just worried about funny because, you know, beer is something that's not necessarily politically correct. And Bud Light especially was a brand that was. I mean, it was like funny. It was humorous. It was like always edgy. It was interesting. And that's what made it the largest beer brand in the country. And then as soon as you get away from that, and as soon as you lose that trust with your customer base, it's really hard to get it back because, you know, the reason this boycott was so successful is for 95% of Americans, they can't tell the difference between Bud Light, Coors Light, Miller Light. I mean, it's almost a commodity product. Mm-hmm. And the brand itself is what makes it unique and distinct. And all of a sudden, when the consumer is confused, wait, I thought Bud Light was this funny, the was up, the I love you, man. Like, that was sort of that bratty, fun humor. And all of a sudden now, is that what Bud Light's about? Or is Bud Light now a brand like Ben & Jerry's? Where, you know, brands like Ben & Jerry's, like they say in their website, like, we're a politically progressive brand. We use ice cream to drive a social mission. And that's really where the company screwed up, is after doing this partnership with Dylan, who was incredibly controversial, but had previously been at the Biden White House, was advocating for biological men to compete against women in sports, was advocating for gender affirmation care. I mean, almost became the face of this very political and very polarizing movement. And for Bud Light to do a partnership with them, like, that was obviously a mistake. But then I think even more telling is the company's response.
Their response was non-response. Anson, hold on for just a second. We've got to take a quick break. I'm Mike Boyle, and we're talking beer. We're talking Anheuser-Busch. Yeah, on the Mike Boyle Restaurant Show with Anson Frerich.
You got it. I think the third time's the charm there. I think we got it. The last one of the
Frerich. Now you're going to make me nervous. Now I'm going to screw it up. Anyway, former president of Anheuser-Busch Sales and Distribution. We're talking about his book, Last Call for Bud Light, The Fall and Future of America's Favorite Beer, because it's not just about beer. It's about societal change. And I just found it to be a fascinating read. Anson, in the restaurant business, I've always felt very strongly that whenever private equity gets involved, you generally see customer service go down. There's an airline that's going through some of that right now. We all know some major restaurant groups that have gone through private equity acquisitions, and They say, well, if a server can handle four tables, why don't we have the server handle eight tables? The bean counters say, look how much money we'll save. You know, that's kind of that was the impression that I got when InBev bought Anheuser-Busch. Might not have been a private equity deal, but would you take the listeners through a definition of stockholder-focused versus stakeholder-focused? We touched on it a bit. Stockholders focus, drive the money, profit for the shareholders. Stakeholders, let's make sure we're more interested in the ESG, the DEI.
Yeah, no, happy to do so. And over the last couple of years, I think a lot of people started scratching their heads when they've seen companies like, you know, again, Coca-Cola getting involved in the voting rights issues in Georgia.
You bet. We saw
Disney get involved in the parental rights issues and the Don't Say Gay Bill down in so-called Don't Say Gay Bill down in Florida. You saw companies that took stances on Roe v. Wade. And I think a lot of people were scratching their heads saying, like, why are companies all of a sudden getting involved in all these social and political issues? Mm-hmm. And it goes back, I mean, almost like 50 years to this philosophical discussion of what's the purpose of a corporation. And here in the U.S., we've always decided the purpose of a corporation since Milton Friedman in the 1970s wrote this famous op-ed in the New York Times, essentially saying the purpose of a corporation is to make money for its shareholders, since they're the owners of the business. How do they do that? They focus on great products and services and their customer base. That allows them to generate more revenue, hire more people, do more innovation, you know, grow an office space, and then, you know, give back to the community in whatever way via taxes or whatever way is authentic to that business. There was a separate philosophy in the world. It was called stakeholder capitalism. And this was espoused by Klaus Schwab, who was over in Europe. He was a European economist. And he started the World Economic Forum. It's more this globalist view that says, no, the purpose of a corporation is to serve all stakeholders equally. And a stakeholder can be anybody. It can be the government. It can be activists. It can be nonprofits. Anybody can be a so-called stakeholder. And this European view compared to the U.S. view, we almost had 50 years to compare the two of them. And both purported to do the same thing, which was to make more money and also do better societally. And if you take a look at it, I mean, the U.S. model has trounced the European model of the last 50 years. Our stock market returns 10% a year on average versus Europe has been 7. Put into context, you've got $100,000 in the U.S. in the 1970s versus Europe. You'd have $4.5 million today in U.S. broad-based indices versus $1.5 million in Europe. So massive difference in terms of that company interest. And then also, Europe would say, okay, well, maybe we have less money, but do we have a better society? And I would say I reject that. If you look at any broad-based prosperity metric, GDP growth, per capita income, unemployment, inflation, the U.S. has trounced Europe on all those over the last 50 years. So I believe in this market of American free market shareholder capitalism. Business should stick to what their mission is, do that, don't get involved in all these other political issues. But over the last 10 years, this European model has really crept into the U.S. It really started creeping in after kind of 2008, 2009, the Great Recession we had. A lot of the banks got bailed out, and then a lot of main Street folks felt like they were left behind. Occupy Wall Street pops up and says, we want, you know, kind of retribution for the 99%. So then all these Wall Street firms start adopting this stakeholder capitalism, ESG, DEI philosophy to try and repair their image. And then also it was really accelerated when Trump was first elected in 2016, and Trump pulled out of things like the Paris Climate Accords, human rights coalitions, all these globalist organizations. And then so all of a sudden you had a lot of these European sovereign wealth funds, which have trillions of dollars of assets. You have progressive pensions like California and New York that were putting a lot of pressure on the BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, these large asset managers that manage almost $20 trillion of capital, to now start solving a lot of these sort of political issues that business hadn't been solving historically, or Trump wasn't going to do. And now they said, okay, now it's got to be Nike, and it's got to be McDonald's, and it's got to be Anheuser-Busch that's going to solve, whether it's climate change or systemic racism or transgendered issues, which those businesses were never in the business of doing that. And as we've seen, this has been problematic because all these companies that got involved in these issues lost millions of consumers, lost billions of dollars of value, had to fire tons of employees, and that was the least sustainable thing that these businesses could have done over the last couple of years.
Well, and I've always believed, call me a simple man, but, you know, America from a position of strength can do so much more. Go back to World War II. That's one prime example. Corporations can do a lot more. I always say, who does more for mankind? whatever mankind is. A big, large corporation that can give money here, give money there, develop different systems, save some money on production there, or the kid that gets out of college and goes digs irrigation ditches in Nicaragua with the Peace Corps. You know, but I think that the corporations can do so much more. And when people say big corporations, it's like saying chain restaurant. They throw it around like it's a pejorative, and I don't see it being that way. I think that the corporations, like you said, if they can give the public a good product, put out a product, and how's that based? It's based on sales. You can have the best product in the world, but if you don't sell it, you've still got it. So obviously the market will determine that, and the market determined it with Budweiser and Bud Light until the marketing campaigns decided to go in a different direction. You know, talk a little bit about how has the book been received at InBev and Bud and from former associates and friends?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that if I think about the beer industry, there's certain people that I've obviously called out and I think need to be more accountable for the millions of customers have been lost and billions of dollars washed down the drain. I mean, their CEO, Brendan Whitworth, I don't think he's received it very well because I've called for him to essentially like lose his job because there's been no accountability for what happened, which I think is crazy in this day and age that we live in. So, you know, I don't think he's probably received it well. But for the other, I mean, thousands of employees and then tens of thousands of people that work at independent, family-owned distributors that distribute beer for Anheuser-Busch across the country, it's been incredibly well-received. Because they've said, man, this is like just common sense.
You know what? We've all had to say, we apologize. We all have had to say, I'm sorry. But the unwillingness of the Budweiser corporate structure from the leadership, from the very top, to say this was a mistake. You know what? Yeah, I suppose you run the risk of alienating a segment of the population that is 0.2%, as opposed to all of your former loyal beer drinkers. But what do you suppose led to the inability to just say, we shouldn't have done this, we made a mistake?
Yeah, this goes back to this problem. It's like European stakeholder. Well, I think it's ego, but it's also that. So, again, the company is European-owned. It's Belgian-owned. And the board members, I think a lot of them believe in this European stakeholder capitalism philosophy that businesses need to social engineer, get more involved in social and political issues. So I think there's just a philosophical difference in Europe versus where I think the U.S. is going. And so I think part of it is a board level down essentially said you cannot apologize, you cannot take responsibility. And so the CEO here in the U.S., they were kind of between a rock and a hard place a little bit. But therefore, I mean, you still have to. They still had multiple chances to come out. That was the path to redemption goes through forgiveness.
Well,
but
you didn't have to.
They
didn't have to grovel. They could just acknowledge. There's a big difference.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you can. I think if they had come out and they said, "Listen, like Bud Light, just authentically was never involved in social political issues. It was involved. It was enjoyed by Democrats and Republicans alike. It was about sports and music and football." You know, we shouldn't have been involved with Dylan Mulvaney because that's not our brand, that's not our image. I think that most people would have understood that and got that. And sure, they would have lost like that 0.2% percentage of the population that probably doesn't drink beer anyway, but so be it. And then Bud Light, they just could have gone back to selling beer in good times, but they've still, haven't recovered at all, lost 50% of their customer base. And a lot of it was ego-driven. I think a lot of it was just like philosophically, the European mind can't comprehend, I think, sort of the American way of doing business sometime, what's good for the America long-term. So I know. I think that probably InBev should sell that U.S. business unit back here in the U.S. so somebody new can come in, do that apology, do it authentically, and get the brands back to growth. So we'll see.
Do you think this? I told you at the University of Hawaii we would study Harvard case study. Maybe if I'd have paid a little bit more of attention, I would have risen to the corporate heights that you have achieved, Anson. But do you think that this will become a Harvard case study? Or will Harvard not admit that one of their alums actually created this campaign?
Oh no! I mean, it's already become a Harvard case study. So Harvard, I was asking
a little tongue in cheek because it certainly should be.
Yeah. So it's actually Harvard does a pretty good job of calling out when the alums do poor work. Uh-huh. I think one of the most famous case studies they do now is there's an Enron case, and Jeffrey Skilling was the CEO of Enron.
Right.
HBS grad, and I think that in the year like 2000, 2001, Enron was the number one destination for HBS grads. So they now teach that case study as what can go wrong, and let folks know that that you gotta make sure you're paying attention in class so you don't repeat the mistakes of others. So it's obviously already a case study, and I think this will go down in history as probably the worst branding mistake, you know, since New Coke, and even more detrimental than New Coke. At least Coke came out, said they apologized, and they went back to the old recipe. Still, Anheuser-Busch hasn't come out and apologized their consumer base, and that's why they still haven't been able to drive a turnaround or comeback story.
All right, I've got to let you go. I know he's very busy. I know he's got another appointment. What do you drink? What beer do you drink, Anson?
These days, I know I've been drinking a lot of like my local craft beers.
Sure.
Also, I love a beer called Outlaw Brewing. That's actually out in Colorado. Mm-hmm. Tivoli does that one, so Outlaw's really good as well. Mm-hmm. And I would still love to drink a Budweiser with my fellow colleagues here. I just hope that, I don't know, Anheuser-Busch finds a new leader or who knows, maybe new owners that can let folks know that it's American-owned, American-made, American values once again. So we'd love that opportunity in the future as well.
I've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
With Anson. Anson
Frerich, how'd I do?
You see the S at the end. Then you got it. Frerich with the S
Frerichs,
at the end.
Frerichs, yeah.
All right.
There
you go.
It's Anson, last name, Frerichs. I got to tell you a story about how Budweiser has owned St. Louis. So the All-Star Game is in St. Louis in 2009. I went to the All-Star Game for 40 years, Anson, and would always get a bunch of my old college army drinking buddies. We'd meet, get in on Sunday. Monday, we'd find the biggest steakhouse in town, go out and blow a lot of money. We didn't care about the home run hitting contest. Go to the game. Wednesday, we'd fly out. Just guys being guys. You know what I mean. Just exactly who the beer companies want. So we're going to go to Shannon's Steakhouse, owned by Mike Shannon. Mike Shannon was a high school baseball player in St. Louis, went on to play for the St. Louis Cardinals, became the Cardinal broadcaster. And when his wife developed cancer, Augie Bush says, "Mike, don't worry. You will always have a place in the Cardinal organization." So when he opened his restaurant, he said, "I'm never going to serve anything but Budweiser products." And so I was going to, you know, I heard about Shannon. So I said, I called the GM. I said, "I got 12 guys coming." I said, "But I'm not drinking Budweiser." He said, "Mike, we'll have Coors for you. It'll be in an ice bucket. We'll set it right by your chair. I just appreciate it if you don't blast it." I said, "Okay." The guy comes to take the order. We order this, we order that. I said, I'll have a Coors. And the waiter looks at me, he never lost a beat. He'd been there for years. He'd never missed a beat. He said, let me check on that, sir. I'll be right back." And he came back with a smile. So the next day, we go to the game. And I said, "I'm not drinking a Budweiser. My loyalty to Coors is very strong, just like your loyalty to Budweiser while you were working there, Anson, was supreme." So I walk all over Busch Stadium and cannot find anything. So I said, "Well, I'm not going to drink a Budweiser. I'm going to drink a Shock Top." So I had about 50 of them. Then I found out the Shock Top is made by Budweiser.
Yep.
I showed them.
They had a lot of beers these days.
I showed them, didn't I?
That's it. You know, you were paying more money versus the Budweiser, you know, when you had that Shock Top, you were making them more money. But yeah, they have a portfolio of thousands of beers these days.
Happy
to
help.
That's a broader point. They have beers for everybody. They have Ultras for the runner. You got Busch Light for the hunters.
Sure.
You know, Bud Light supposed to be for sports. And they got all types of these craft beers that are, you know, more for the progressive social types. And that's fine. Like, let those brands be those brands that don't force Bud Light to be Ben and Jerry's or you know, what it's not. I think that's what you got to get back to, is more authenticity, because consumers these days will see right through it if you're trying to pander.
Well, and one of the things that I've been told by people very knowledgeable about the beer business is that when it comes to the Bud, Coors, Miller, that's the aircraft carrier. And if you can get those sales up a half of 1%, that's huge. So that a lot of the big boys have either come up with their own beers. Blue Moon is the largest craft beer in the world, I understand. May not be, but it was for a long time. But I also know, you talk about Atlanta. I was down in Atlanta, and I was at a craft beer house called Terrapin. And I said, well, I'm a lager guy. I like something like a Coors Banquet. What do you have? He says, I got the right thing for you. He pours it. I said, oh, this is really good. It does taste like a Coors. And he said, well, it should. We're owned by Coors. So the big boys have, the big boys have bought some of these craft beer houses that they thought could help them grow their product.
Yeah, I mean, they've bought a lot of these over the years. Yeah, Miller Coors bought Terrapin. Anheuser-Busch owns Goose Island, Elysian. They don't Breckenridge out in Colorado, but they sold that to another company called Tilray. So, no, they bought tons of these over the years as consumer, you know, taste changes. And, those, and some of those brands, I mean, like Anheuser-Busch owns Elysian. And Elysian, they have a whole, you know, like transgender day that they do up there with, the, you know, in Seattle. And great, like nobody cares about that because that's, you know, part of their brand and that's what they do up in Seattle. But then again, that wasn't Bud Light. I think that's sort of the lesson to be learned. Have your portfolio of brands, serve everybody, but, you know, don't make Bud Light into, again, an Elysian beer or a Ben & Jerry's ice cream. I think we'll all be better off for it.
Do you miss the beer business? Because I think the beer business is a happy business, tremendously competitive. I love doing my radio show. I talk about restaurants and travel. I don't have to get into the 24/7 news cycle, all of the vitriol between this party, that party, this side, that side. Do you miss the beer business? I can only give you about 30 seconds to sum it up.
No, I do, man. I love the beer business. There's no better people than beer people. And then Anheuser-Busch, his original motto was making friends is our business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you're in the business of being around people and being social and then having a couple beers, telling some good stories, and there's nothing better. And I think some of the best probably marketing campaigns of the What's Up guys, the Roman Genius,
sure,
that came from sitting around and having some good beers. So, yeah, I definitely miss the business. I have a lot of friends in it. I still maintain my involvement with some investments that I have, but it's a great business and a lot of fun to be in.
All right. His name is Anson Frericks, and he's the author of Last Call for Bud Light, The Fall and Future of America's Favorite Beer. I would imagine you can get it at all the usual suspects. I found mine on Amazon. Anson, I can't thank you enough. I think it was a fascinating book. It's a fascinating story, and I think that you shed a lot of light. In a word, will Bud Light ever recapture the number one position in American beer sales?
Well, I mean, I hope that they do. They got a long road ahead of them, but I'm rooting for them. And I don't think, again, current leadership's going to do it, but I think the right people can make it happen. I'd love to see a great American comeback story.
That'll have to be the last word. Thanks, Anson. We really appreciate you.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, let's take a break on the Mike Boyle Restaurant Show.